Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and as you just heard in the news, Governor Cuomo has just announced changes to the plan to shut down the L train. It's big news for the city, in particular for L train riders and many of the journalists who cover the L train riders. Gothamist reporters are at the Manhattan press conference right now, as well as in the studio with me. Christopher Robin broke the story about the original shutdown for Gothamist back in 2016, almost exactly 3 years ago.
Was that the case? Yes.
So just so people have an understanding, how big a deal is it that the governor just announced this?
This is a huge deal. This shutdown was going to affect 250,000 New Yorkers who take the L train into Manhattan for Brooklyn every day. The city was planning on, you know, putting HOV restrictions on the Williamsburg Bridge, creating a bus lane on 14th Street. People moved. People made decisions on where they're going to work based on this shutdown. And now, 3 months and change before it was supposed to happen, the governor is now saying that instead of shutting down the tunnel, for constant work, he's going to use some sort of new kinds of technology. He hasn't specified what yet. He's still making the announcement to shut the tunnel down on nights and weekends, one of the two tunnels. So service will presumably still happen on nights and weekends, just limited service. But again, we don't know for how long. We don't know. A lot of these details are just being released as we're talking.
Well, just as we're having this conversation, to remind people, what was the original plan?
So, the MTA and the city spent years debating whether to shut the L train down totally for either 18 months or 15 months, or to keep it open with limited service for 3 years. And they reached this conclusion because people hate delays and closures on nights and weekends. Lots of New Yorkers still use the subways on nights and weekends to get to their jobs, to, move around. So, they settled on this 15-month plan because they thought it would be the, it's ripping the Band-Aid off, the least painful way to make the repairs that are necessary. But, apparently the governor thinks differently. And this is the same governor who, repeatedly has declined to take responsibility for the MTA, says he doesn't control the MTA. But now he seems to be, stepping in and saying, no, we can do this differently.
Do you have any sense of why this is happening? Is this pressure coming from somewhere? Or is this just part of his new found progressivism?
I think you're onto something there. I think, he definitely feels pressure to sort of step up and do more things. But, there's a lot of real estate along the Brooklyn waterfront. And those residents would be affected by L train shutdown. Maybe we should be following the money, who's going to be doing these repairs now? Is it going to be the same contractors as before? Work has already started on some parts of the L train tunnel repairs. So, I'm gobsmacked right now as I'm sitting here talking to you.
All right. Well, go do some more reporting. We'll drag you back here in a little bit. That's Christopher Robin. Thank you so much for helping us walk through the beginning parts of this developing story. Of course, WNYC will be all over the story all afternoon. If you're just joining us, Governor Cuomo has announced changes to the plan to shut down the L train for earlier. Well, this was happening later this year, actually. My next guest, I've got a whole nice intro prepared for you, Gabrielle, and I'm going to read that intro. Gabrielle Bendir-Vignani is a professor and an author, and we're going to talk to her a little bit about Contested City, about the Seward Park plan. We're calling it Essex Crossings now. It's got a fancy name. But while we have you in studio, and you're listening to this, and you're this is developing news, and this is what you do, urban planning and discussing it and the history of it. What comes to your mind?
Well, on one hand, it makes me think, that's an incredible shift, right, to make so soon and to where that's going to actually happen. And so what does that mean? And I think this question of following the money, even though on one hand, it seems like we should all be celebrating the fact that this isn't maybe going to happen. And on the other hand, there's that voice in the back of my head that says, but why? But why? And why aren't we only finding this out now? So, you know, and in many ways, this is the story of lots of development in New York. And so, you know, how do we kind of look at that? And, you know, is it about the kinds of investments that have been happening, say, on the Brooklyn waterfront? You know, mm-hmm. are we protecting that? Is that what this kind of the background of it is?
Is it the fact that Google's on the other end?
Right. I mean,
on 8th Avenue and 14th Street?
Exactly. So, you know, what's shifted in this last couple of months that's kind of led us to this, which is the question I think we should all be asking. On the other hand, it's like wonderful to hear about that, and it certainly will change a lot of people's lives or improve a lot of people's lives. But, you know, what is it and what does that mean in the longer term, or what does it put off for the longer term, right? There's the hugest questions possible for thinking about the MTA.
And the WYC newsroom will be on it. Okay, I'm going to do your official introduction now.
Wonderful.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
3, 2, 1. If you're a regular visitor to Manhattan's Lower East Side or a long-term resident, you may have noticed large plots of vacant land right around the Delancey-Essex stop that have now become construction sites. Now known as Essex Crossing, these plots of land have historically been known as the Seward Park Urban Renewal Area, or SPURA. They were initially tenement houses and co-ops in the city that forced residents to vacate in the 60s. Many of the buildings sat empty for years before being razed. All in all, 1,852 families were displaced and were promised that they would be given the opportunity to move back into affordable housing units that would eventually be built on the sites of their former homes. Instead, what resulted was a 50-year-long fight for affordable housing. Here to help us break down this complex history is artist, curator, and visiting assistant professor at the New School, Gabrielle Bendinier-Vianney. She is also, along with her several of her classes, has created a project called Layered Spura, which looks at fostering open-ended dialogue in this contentious fight. Her new book right here is titled Contested City, Art and Public History as Meditation at New York's Seward Park Urban Renewal Area. You argue in the book, this is a great passage, I want to read it. Spura's complex, little-known, and often opaque histories touch on many of the most powerful elements that have shaped American cities. Urban renewal, fights for and affordable housing, discrimination and quota systems, urban disinvestment and gentrification, to name a few. Hence, it helps us understand other places too. Thank you so much for being here and also for diving in on the L train discussion.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You're a native New Yorker. How did you come to learn about Spura?
I absolutely am, and I think that's really a big part of the way that I came to learn about Spura. So I grew up in New York. I have a huge affection for it. I really care about the city. I teach about urban studies. This is what I do all the time. And grew up going to the Lower East Side with my family, you know, kind of harking back both sides of my family, have connections to the Lower East Side. And at one point, I was starting, right when I started to teach at the New School, I was starting to talk with Marcy Reaven, who was part of an organization called City Lore at the time. And we were thinking, well, what would it look like to develop a class where there's a partnership around kind of community work and thinking about making things public at the same as thinking about kind of what does that look like for pedagogy around understanding cities. And she said, well, I think that's a great idea, and I'd love to collaborate with you, but, you know, the only thing I have going on right now is this crazy Spura situation. And I was like, Spura?
Spura situation?
What's that? And so this is 2008, and we took a long walk from the New School to the corner of Grand and Essex, and on the way, she told me the potted history, basically, of this site and the ways in which she had started getting involved and collaborating with an organization called Good Old Lower East Side, which is also known as GOLS.
Oh.
Yeah, who's been a long-term activist on housing around the Lower East Side. And when we arrived at the corner of Grand and Essex, and as I'd been sort of listening to this story and going, wait, what? And then, wait, tell me what, when that happened? We got there and I thought, I've been here a million times. How do I not know this story? And that was really part of the thing that drove me to think a lot more deeply about the site and to commit a lot of years of my life mm-hmm. to working with it and working on it, because it was such a powerful story and such an important story, but also one that it's not just me that didn't know about it, but that many people, unless you were really quite directly affected, it wasn't a well-known story, and yet it's such a complicated one and one that really touches on the stories of lots of parts of New York.
And it points to all the issues.
Right.
It's just like just all of them in one
right.
big one big bowl. You quote an activist as saying, unless it's written, it never happened. This is very significant when you think about how it relates to discriminations, particularly in this case.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's one of the things that really also kind of helped me keep going in writing the book, is thinking about, well, what are the points of, you know, what's the point of writing a book about this? You know, what's the point of my writing a book about it? What's the point of doing work around it? And part of it really is to kind of have this story be out in the world, as opposed to being only known by people who've lived it and experienced it. That's incredibly important and powerful, that people kind of have lived and experienced it and stay involved and invested in it. But also, how do we make that more public so that people really understand what happened at Spura? And so that even in this moment where, you know, very big and shiny new buildings are being built there, what happens so that there's not an erasure of both the history of why those buildings were torn down in the first place, but also the multiple levels of history, discrimination, and really long-term and incredible activism that happened since then, so that those things aren't erased and we don't forget about those things and we don't lose the way that that helps us understand the rest of the city.
All right, let's do a little timeline for
Absolutely.
Folks. So the Lower East Side, it was a landing point for many immigrant groups in the 19th and 20th century. So at that time, the clearing of the buildings, who was living in this neighborhood?
Sure. So the site was declared an urban renewal site in 1967. And at that time, in this particular swath of the neighborhood, which is about 14 square blocks, pretty large area of solidly packed tenement buildings, it was an incredibly diverse neighborhood, mostly lower income people of color, but incredible diversity in that group, and also groups of Holocaust survivors as well. So you have these people kind of who had been refugees after World War II had settled back in the neighborhood. So it wasn't always this kind of older generation of people who'd live on the Lower East Side, but newer immigrants of all different kinds coming to the Lower East Side. There's a very significant Puerto Rican population at Seward Park. And that there was a very, you know, people talk about it as an incredible neighborhood that they've never really experienced since. And you might be kind of tempted to see that as like a sort of a past looking back kind of nostalgia of like, it was all so much better and we all got along and all that kind of thing. But what's interesting about that is that because there's so much historical record and court cases and discrimination sort of lawsuits brought around the kind of housing and discrimination that happened on the site later, we actually can see pretty closely about census records and court records of who was there and what the racial breakdown was. And so there was a very significant group of number of families who were Puerto Rican, but also African American, also Jewish, white, and also a smaller number, but certainly present, of Asian families who were there. It was really at the beginning of this, at 67, was really the beginning of kind of the emergence of Chinatown in that area. So there was a smaller number of Asian families there, but really kind of significantly diverse and really integrated as those blocks.
So why was it decided that this area needed to be cleared and renewed, which a lot of people, they say urban renewal and you hear urban removal. That's, you know.
Absolutely. And I think that was one of the things that, you know, many people talk about as urban renewal. People alternately talk about it as Negro renewal, right? Or removal,
yeah.
Right? And so that was a phrase used at the time, and it was certainly applicable in this situation, right? People also talk about it as Latino removal, right? And so those things are real, and those were part of urban renewal across the board. It's not specific to Spura. It's one of the many things that happened across New York City and across the country, and the ways in which this kind of vast removal of people was really deployed in neighborhoods of color and where people often didn't have the chance to kind of mobilize and fight back against it.
It was in the name of what? Was it just progress?
So in the name of progress, certainly. And, you know, I mean, so at the time, so all of this is under the auspices of the Slum Clearance Committee, with a fantastic
name,
right? Right. So already you're kind of like going crazy, right? Led by Robert Moses, also intersecting with one of his other projects, which was the Lower Manhattan Expressway. So he had big plans for taking out part of this neighborhood for an expressway that would cut across all of Lower Manhattan, kind of connecting off of the Williamsburg Bridge. And also that this would be you know, a site of new housing. So on one hand, there's this idea that, you know, urban renewal had been used in many, many ways across the city and made some things that we could argue are incredibly important contributions to the city, right? We can also look at the kinds of displacement that those developments sort of wrought. But it also did develop some of our largest amounts of affordable housing, particularly affordable like ownership housing, co-op housing. So those were also built through urban renewal. Mm-hmm. The thing that happened at Spurra, and part of the reason that, you know, part of the reason that people left was they were promised the right to come back. And they said, you know, we're going to build enough apartments for all of you to be able to return, right? There was, and it's talked about in this way, as a right to return. And that was part of the deal of leaving, that people would be temporarily relocated and be able to come back. And part of what happened at Spurra was that the way that urban renewal functions is that the city doesn't redevelop a site. They have a sponsor. And that person, that organization is the kind of, mm-hmm. They are the developer of the site. The developer of this site was supposed to be the United Housing Federation, which had developed many other urban renewal sites for moderate income co-ops often around the city. Just on the other opposite side of Grand Street, they had developed those. Had done a lot of work in the Bronx as well. So had this real history of building housing that was affordable. But they, at some point, for many reasons, decided they would pull out before the buildings were demolished. And so the city went ahead in starting in 67 and 68 to demolish buildings without having a sponsor to build anything to replace them.
Wow.
And so that's part of the tragedy of mm-hmm. Spurra, is that not only does it kind of pull up all these questions about displacement and who's being displaced, but also these questions of the fact that people were being displaced without really any promise of what was going to come to be able to be a place for them to come back to.
Now, to be clear, was there ever affordable housing for them to come back to?
Ever built?
Yes.
Yes, in bits and pieces.
Okay.
So
but only certain people were welcome back.
Right. So, you know, the plot thickens as soon as you go forward with it. Yes. So the first sponsor to build housing on that site was the New York City Housing Authority, so NYCHA, to build two buildings of public housing on that site, which is called the Seward Park Extension Buildings. And one of them, and they exist today, they're there. One of them is on between Delancey and Broome, and the other is on the corner of Grand and Essex. And those two buildings, when they were built, people were very excited about them. You know, they were going to be modern apartments. You know, many of the tenements that were torn down, they weren't in great condition. People were like, okay, you're going to give me like a better looking house? Like, okay, I would go for that. Many of those apartments that were built in Seward Park Extension, you know, they were very nice apartments. Everything worked. It was all great. There were elevators, you know, this wasn't walk-ups. And people were promised that they would have the priority to come back. And so people started to do that. They said, okay, I'm going to come to the rental office. I'm going to try and lease these apartments. And what people were finding was that families of color were turning up and they were saying, okay, here's my proof. This is where I lived. I wanted one of those apartments. And they were saying, oh, I'm sorry. They're all rented. And people started to notice that there was a pattern, that the majority of families who were getting apartments in those two buildings were white and Jewish.
Did they give a reason why?
Oh, later in the court cases that were brought against them, they gave some very significant reasons why, and which only really evolved through kind of direct action and the kind of, you know, people taking over the rental offices, having sit-ins, really kind of vital and important kinds of activist work that was happening there. And one of the arguments that NYCHA made at the time was they, and really reinscribed in the court cases, was this idea of a tipping point, that they argued that were they to let the people of color who had lived there before return, there would be this notion that it would be too many colored people in the neighborhood and would tip the neighborhood, and it would lead to this notion of white flight, right? And so all, which on all of that language is part of the way that they talked about it in those court cases. And so these are the legal documents in which NYCHA was trying to defend that, defend the decisions that they had made about who they would lease to.
There were all those. Washington, D.C. did the same thing with these housing covenants.
Right.
But some of them still kind of exist. The name of the book is Contested City, Art and Public History as Mediation at New York's Seward Park Urban Renewal Area. I do want to fast forward a little bit because what's going on there now? Because people can go there right now, and I want to talk about your project a little.
Sure.
So we've got this thing that they're calling Essex Crossing, which is a nice name. You give something. I'm just, messaging. How significant is messaging?
Oh, incredibly significant, and so significant to the sort of to go from also to take that kind of urban renewal area thing out and to rename it, right? And on one hand, you can see why Spura itself might not be the most kind of potent name, but also one of the things that that name holds within it is both this history of deep pain, but also deep activism, the things that people rallied around to make that change, to make something happen on that site really is embedded in that word of, you know, in that name of being called Spura.
So you really feel like that needs to still be attached.
I think it does. I think it does. I mean, I can completely understand why it is not, but I think we still need to retain that name and when we talk about it and as we kind of think about what that space is. On the other hand, that neighborhood, you know, it was something before it was an urban renewal area too. So there's a way in which, you know, we don't want to kind of erase that only in kind of keeping it to be about the urban renewal, right? So there's a lot to be said about kind of thinking about the way that we call it, right? I mean, you know, I think a lot about this in connection with other work that I've done in Brooklyn, right? At the around the Barclays Center, right? And so that was Atlantic Yards, right? Now is Pacific Park, right? It's like we've switched oceans and now it's a park instead of a yard, right? But it's like, but it erases so much of those histories that we really need to think about the contestation that's at the core of these places.
So. And also retain it so that we learn from it. That's the other part. If you just keep erasing it, it'll keep happening again and again. So tell me a little bit about, so this big glossy thing is happening down there. If anybody who's been down there, you can see it. There's going to be a food hall and there's going to be apartments and it's their name. It is cool that one of the buildings is named after Sonny Rollins.
Yes, that is cool.
That's a cool thing.
That's a cool thing.
That's a cool thing.
He seems a little bewildered about it. I've heard some stuff. He was like, well, that's great.
Your project of layered Spura. Explain to folks what it is and what you hope it achieves.
Sure. So the project really started in 2008 when I started to work with good old Lower East Side, with City Lore, with the Pratt Center, where they were really trying to build a conversation and a grassroots conversation from the bottom up to before any of this Essex Crossing business was happening to say, well, what would it look like to actually start a community conversation about this site and the future of this site? And so one of our contributions to that coalition of people working together on this was to build, to do a series of exhibitions for 5 years about Seward Park or about Seward Park Urban Renewal Area itself as a place, as its history, as a place where people had lived, that they cared about, that they loved, and to bring that kind of humanity back to it and to take it away from the kind of the only dialogue that was happening was around, you know, how many developable square feet is it, right? At the time, it was the largest undeveloped city-owned plot of land south of 96th Street, is very significant amount of space. But one of the things that we really wanted to talk about was like, well, this is and was people's homes. So how can exhibitions and creative practices also help us see that, right? How do we build in oral history, all of those things that help us sort of let us see the city as a human place, not just a place of, you know, possible building. And so Layered Spura was a project in conjunction with a class that I taught called City Studio at the New School, in which I brought all of my students into collaboration with all of the folks who were working on this coalition, which was called Spura Matters, and to develop these exhibitions each year that were community-based exhibitions. And one of the things that the book is about is both about the development of those exhibitions and also about the kind of what those spaces have the possibility to create. One of the things I always thought about, you know, I thought, oh, this is going to be great. We're going to have all these images. I think photography is fantastic. I think people's stories are wonderful. But I think I didn't really understand what the whole thing was about until we got to one of the exhibition openings. And there were quite a few people there who were a little angry that we were doing an exhibition about Spurra. Because they were saying, what are you saying in our name? And who has the right to talk about Spurra? And it ended up being a lot of people from sort of opposite sides of the kind of argument about Spurra, which had been going on for about 40 years turning up at this exhibition. And somebody sort of leaned over to me and said, you know, I've never seen those two people in the same room without screaming at each other. And I thought, oh, okay, maybe that's what we're doing.
There you go.
You know, maybe that's this possibility. And so it's really made me think about the possibility for both Spurra itself, but also this kind of practice in our very contested cities going forward is, what does it mean to both sort of, I don't think that an exhibition solves any problems. And there is a huge amount of work that brought us from nothing to the pretty significant agreements that led to Essex Crossing. But one of the things that I really think was important and what I want to take away from it was thinking about how can we make more of those kinds of spaces where people who really are at loggerheads with each other, who can't see each other, can't hear each other, can't mm-hmm. see each other as, you know, other people, have a space to have some sort of even very minor kind of dialogue. And what does it take to get us to that, right? I mean, it's obviously happening at the national level too. But so that was one of the most important things, I think, that really that we took away from doing the Layered Spurra work.
The name of the book is Contested City. My guest has been Gabrielle Bentonier-Vianney. Thank you so much for joining us. This is fascinating. It's really interesting.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful to be here.
You should do a podcast about it. Just saying.
Sounds good.
All of it will be back with the director of a new documentary called Genesis 2.0, which follows researchers and mammoth hunters in Siberia who are attempting to resurrect the woolly mammoth through DNA extraction. This is for real. We'll be back after a quick break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. A new documentary called Genesis 2.0 might make you geek out about the wonders of science, or it might make you freak out about the ethical ramifications of what science can now do. The film focuses on woolly mammoths. Yes, those hulking, hairy, elephantine beasts that roamed the Earth during the Ice Age and have been extinct for 10,000 years. There are scientists who want to bring them back to life. And with DNA sequencing, genomes, cloning, there's one group who believes that we humans are closer to doing so than ever before. Genesis 2.0 was directed by Oscar-nominated filmmaker Christian Frey. It follows a team of mammoth tusk hunters in Siberia, and then scientists as well who may hold the key to resurrecting this species. Genesis 2.0 is now playing at the IFC Center, and there will be a Q&A with Christian Frey tomorrow, and on the 5th with some scientists as well, and Christian Frey's in studio. Hi.
Hi, Allison.
How did you first find out about the mammoth tusk hunters?
Well, it was the other way around. I first was reading a book by superstar George Church, a geneticist. He looks like Darwin or the Godfather himself. And he wrote this book, How Synthetic Biology Will Reinvent Nature and Ourselves. I was like, wow, what a title. And it was about the resurrection also of the woolly mammoth, this dream of bringing back the mammoth by synthetic biology. And while I was reading this chapter, I came across photographs by a Yakutian photographer. She works for National Geographic. She's incredibly gifted, and these photographs were showing the primordial world of the tusk hunters. Tusk hunters, you know, ivory, gold rush, mm-hmm. white gold. I mean, these are people, and they're seeking for the tusks of extinct mammoth. And the more of these people are seeking for the tusk, the more they find the carcass. So that's why then this film is like a combination of the primordial archaic world and our future. And that made me having an epiphany, which I have every 4 years. I have to sit down. I know this is the next 4 years of my life because I'm really slow. You know, I'm a very European documentary filmmaker.
That's fine. That means that you go to all the details and you appreciate and you savor all the details of the film you shoot.
That's true.
So there are two men, two brothers you focus on, and we get to know them in the film, Peter and Semyon. They anchor your story. Could you tell people who they are?
Well, Semyon has a dream. He's director of the Mammoth Museum in Yakutsk. And he has good connection to the tusk hunters because Peter is his brother and he's actually a tusk hunter. Again, it's a documentary. Mm-hmm. It's not fiction. I didn't script that. it's just a gift.
But you did, as a documentary filmmaker, go, thank you from the documentary gods.
I found it. I was lucky enough. So Semyon wants to bring back the woolly mammoth by cloning. This is one way to bring the woolly mammoth back. And cloning, he wants to do it with, Dr. Kwong. He's a very controversial scientist, would say, in Seoul, South Korea. And that's one point of the story. And then Peter, again, he's a tusk hunter and he's very skeptical. He's kind of part of this culture where there is a taboo actually to even penetrate the earth, you know, because Mother Earth is kind of female. It's kind of don't touch, do respect, don't be too greedy stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting because the two brothers are kind of in a conflict.
There's this great line. He says, humans, you just want more, more, more.
Exactly.
And that's sort of the underpinning of a lot of the tension in the film. So it opens with these sweeping views of these men on just digging in the ice and the dirt. They're literally looking for the tusks. Why?
Well, it's money, you know. These are fishermen. It's the very north of Yakutia. There is really no other way to make a living. So in winter times, they are doing just some fishing and maybe hunting. And in the summer, just 2 month window, they are hunting the white gold. As simple as that. It's maybe 120 to 150 men going to the islands. It's very dangerous to polar bears and also fog. You might lose yourself. So it's really dangerous because one or two men are not coming back every year.
Yeah, there's a great scene when you lift up the side of the tent and you just see this giant polar bear. And polar bears are not kind. In children's books, they're cuddly and soft, but they're incredibly ferocious.
If there are mothers and they have a kid, no, they can attack you. Absolutely.
So how much money can these hunters make, and who's buying these mammoth tusks?
Well, you know, it depends on the quality of this ivory. There is like four different qualities. The best quality, A quality, that's $1,000 per kilogram for the hunters themselves. And if the tusk is maybe 90 kilograms, I don't know in pounds, but you might help me, but it's $90,000 for the hunter. So it's really a gold rush. It's very seldom that they are so lucky, but some of them, and of course all of them, dream of doing this lucky punch, you know, like the 90 kilogram class A super tusk. And these kind of tusks go to China, mostly all of them, and they're being carved in maybe 1 or 2 years of work, very kitschy work, by the way, and it ends up by being sold for like $1.5 million.
And as you mentioned earlier, Christian, that there's a certain sort of mythology and belief system about disturbing the earth and disturbing these tusks, and some of the men start to internalize that, and it's very hard to watch.
Yeah, almost all of them internalized it. Actually, they are really in a very mixed way of feelings when they are lucky. On the one hand, they can feed their family, you know, through the next winter, and they are very happy. On the other hand, they can be really also very afraid because they all know the stories of others being too greedy. I mean, there's one story, it's really, really sad. One guy found three, like, super perfect tusks. I mean, the biggest ones, like 2.5 meters each of them. Like, so it's like three times $90,000. But he lost himself. He got out of gasoline. He ran out of water, everything. And finally, the best option he had is to build kind of an ark with these three tusks to hang himself. So these are the stories which are around. So it's really kind of drama. And of course, it's kind of adding to this mythology, but also to the symbolic or to the metaphoric way this film tries to communicate, because it's not only about, you know, the resurrection of the woolly mammoth and these two ways to get there, and it's one part is in Boston, U.S. with George Church, again, the other one in China and in South Korea, but it's I think a more general insight into our future, but also kind of Boeing and being interested in our past. And this is very seldom. You don't have that as a documentary filmmaker so often, mm-hmm. that you kind of have a reference to the past and to the future in the same film.
The name of the film is Genesis 2.0. I'm speaking with Christian Farai, its director. You mentioned at the top this idea of the synthetic biology and George Church, this geneticist you follow around, and as well as and Samen's idea of he wanting to clone these mammoths. There's this one moment in the film when one of the scientists brings up ethics, and the person to whom he asks the question, her face is stone. The ethical considerations around this, as you were filming this, are people, do they discuss it, or are they just enamored with the science of what we possibly could do here?
Well, it's the end of the film, and we are going to China. You know, the film begins by kind of portraying the world of synthetic biology in a positive way. You know, you see the enthusiasm of these students in Boston, and George Church is their superstar. It's like Spielberg would be appearing in a little film festival. So it's very positive. But at the end of the film, one guy is asking a very simple question. Wouldn't be insurance companies interested in our genomes because you can read a lot of the damage coming into our lives. Mm-hmm. And then there is a pan, it's not a cut. And the Chinese lady is answering, well, even better, we can get rid of Down syndrome. Hello? I mean, my sister is handicapped. Mm. What is this kind of thinking behind that? If you want to get rid of everything which is kind of, you know, not okay or handicapping our
lives. And who gets to decide that?
Exactly. And I think the beauty of life is exactly the contrary. You know, it's about everything in life, not this almost fascist idea of a perfect human being. So it's really scary. And this is kind of the finale in the film. Mm-hmm. But then again, you know, before I'm very interested also just in, of course, this crazy plan to bring back the woolly mammoth, et cetera, et cetera.
It's the bigger ideas about what are we potentially unleashing?
Exactly.
What are we saying about each other? What are we saying about this quest? It's the two quests.
Yeah, and I really found out that the resurrection of the woolly mammoth is kind of a PR project. Let's face it. It's a first manifestation of something much bigger. This is the next technological revolution, and it will come. And I wrote this sentence also in my synopsis to find the money, etc., etc. And when I finally, 2 years later, came to China, to Shenzhen, you know, where the two twins have been now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And then that scientist
same
is-
city. And there is a newly built, 2 months ago, opened China National Gene Bank. And what was in front, or still is in front of this China National Gene Bank? A mammoth family. So I knew I was right by this first manifestation, by this PR thing. It's, you know, I mean, mammoths are cute. We have all seen, you know, Jurassic Park. We don't want the dinosaurs back. But we have seen also Ice Age. They have this kind of strange reputation of being cute, which is strange because, I mean, it's huge grass eaters, let's face it. But, you know, everybody wants the mammoth back, and that's why it kind of serves as a PR project.
It's a really interesting juxtaposition between the two different cultures, both grappling with some of the same issues, ethics, because you do it, can do it, should you do it. It's a fascinating film. The name of it is Genesis 2.0. Christian Farai will be doing a Q&A with scientists at the IFC Center this Friday and Saturday after screenings of the film. You can see more and get more information at the IFC Center website. Christian, thanks for joining us on all of it.
Thank you, Alice.
When we come back, a true crime podcast about a small town in Georgia. We'll talk to the investigative reporters working that story after the break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. Murderville is the name of a new true crime podcast about a murder in a Taco Bell parking lot that the local authorities in that town in Georgia say it's been solved. A whole slew of other people say that's a farce. Devani Inman is in prison serving a lifelong sentence for the murder of Donna Brown. From the beginning, there was a significant amount of evidence that suggested Inman, at the very least, did not receive a fair trial, and that local authorities had tunnel vision about him and his alleged guilt. Add to that, witnesses who have since recanted their story, a possible second suspect whose DNA was actually found in Brown's car, but still Georgia authorities will not budge on this conviction. Now you can add another layer to that. There were three more violent murders in this small town while Inman was incarcerated. Welcome to Murderville.
Investigative reporters Ileana Segura and Jordan Smith report in a 7-episode podcast series for The Intercept. It is called Murderville, and Ileana and Jordan, welcome to all of it.
Thank you for having us.
Sure, Ileana. So this happened in 1998, the small town, Adel, Georgia, population about 5,000 people. Donna Brown was murdered in this Taco Bell parking lot. Can you explain the circumstances of her murder?
So Donna Brown was the assistant manager at the Taco Bell, and she had, it was only, you know, her first week on the job when she was apparently leaving her shift after closing out, and was found in sort of early morning hours, shot in the face. Presumably, she had brought out that day's earnings, and those were gone. Her car was later found sort of around the corner over an overpass at an abandoned Pizza Hut. A fair amount of physical evidence was also found at the scene, and that's sort of where things start to go wrong, or at least authorities seem to start to drop the ball. A lot of the evidence was never really thoroughly investigated. So from the beginning, there were a lot of questions about sort of what was and wasn't done to solve this murder.
So, Jordan, what are some of the, there's a lot that's disputed about this case. What are the undisputed facts of this case?
Well, excuse me, that Donna Brown was shot, that her car was taken by her killer and dumped a few blocks away, that the night bank bag with about $1,700 in it was taken and neither thing was ever found. And that they got a man named Devanya Inman and said that he committed this murder, but without any of the physical evidence matching him.
So how was Devanya Inman connected at all to Donna Brown? Why did the police decide to focus on him?
That's a really good question. He wasn't connected to Donna Brown at all. He had a lot of family from Adel. In fact, his extended family were all from Adel, and he had spent some time there over the years on summers, you know, in vacation times. But he grew up in California, and he basically was sent back to Adel in the summer of 1998 by his mother because he'd been having some run-ins with the law in California, and she thought it would be a good place for him to be in the country. But it didn't turn out that way. And I think it's partially, you know, there is the issue that he's an outsider in this town, and outsiders tend to stick out. And maybe that's a good thing or a bad thing, depending on who you are. And also, he has a lot of troubling qualities, I guess you could say. He's had some trouble with the law, and particularly with violence against women. It is not something that should be sugarcoated, but I think that's really how the cops kind of knew who he was, because he had a girlfriend in this town and there had been some domestic incidents between the two of them.
So you mentioned him being an outsider. You two are outsiders as well. Jordan, you're in Austin, and Ileana, you work in Nashville. You're both investigative reporters. You know you got to hit the ground. You got to go down to Adel. You have to start making phone calls, doing shoe leather reporting. How were you received when you landed?
Well, it's kind of funny. It was a bit surreal going down there. You know, neither of us is particularly new to the South, although I will say South Georgia is a particular kind of slice of the South, even to people we've talked to in and around Atlanta. You know, it's kind of a whole different place, Cook County. As one lawyer put it, it's a place where the law doesn't quite work. The legal system doesn't quite work in any way that's recognizable to this lawyer we spoke to in Atlanta, and he's from Georgia himself. So there was a bit of a learning curve, I will say, but it's not giving anything away to say that the first time we arrived in Adel, and we were traveling with Jessica Fino, this attorney who was sort of our way into this story. She was kind of giving us the lay of the land, and one of our first meetings was actually with the local, a man who, the editor of the local newspaper, who had covered some of these, all of these murders at the time that they happened. And you know, we got to know him a little bit, asked him some questions about what he had and hadn't covered. But it was, no sooner had we left Adel than we find there's a, was it a front page story, Jordan? There was basically a story about us coming to Adel to investigate this case, which was not how we had hoped to be introduced to this town. You know, we'd hoped to kind of develop our sources and start, you know, trying to be sort of subtle and cautious about how we proceeded. Instead, it was kind of announced to the world in the newspaper that we were there to look into this case.
And you guys are very transparent in the podcast. podcast about some of the difficulties you had getting people to talk to you. I want to play a little bit of a call you had with Chief Deputy Hill. Let's listen.
Isn't it a clue when I don't return your call, I don't intend to talk to you?
Well, no, not necessarily.
I'm not talking to you.
Well, can you tell me why not?
Yes, because I don't want to talk to you.
But I mean, is there...
Now, you have a nice day.
And Jamie Steinberg, the GBI investigator.
My colleague and I are in town looking into this old case you worked on, the 1998 murder of Donna Brown at the Taco Bell. And we're hoping that we might be able to meet with you and kind of maybe ask you some of your recollections about that case.
No, ma'am, I'm not gonna discuss the case. It's been adjudicated. I'm not going to talk to you about it.
It seems they couldn't be bothered with questions about a case they consider closed. There were a lot of people who did talk to us, though. And the Georgia Bureau of Investigation.
That was a clip from Murderville. I'm talking to Liliana Segura and Jordan Smith, the reporters who worked on this podcast. So you did mention that you got to talk to a lot of people. Those two gentlemen didn't want to talk to you. Who did you get to speak to for the podcast that you think it's really significant and really sort of kind of makes the podcast for you and made your reporting experience full?
Well, a couple of people. I think some really critical witnesses. For one of the key people who's complicated herself, it was a woman named Marquetta Thomas, and she's sort of the first main person who implicated Vanya Inman, only to take back her statement multiple times. And she told us, you know, she was ignored from the moment she first tried to say, you know, I lied when I said he was involved in this. She was the sister of Devanya Inman's then girlfriend. She had a lot of reasons to have beef with Devanya Inman. But when we met with her, she spent a significant amount of time in prison after this. And she, you know, she's from all sort of signs. So she's a different person now. And she was filled with remorse for her role in putting Devanya Inman away in prison. And so she was a really critical person that we spoke to of several other people. And I'll let Jordan talk about one of our other favorite characters, I think.
Jordan.
Lloyd? Yeah. I mean, there's a lot Lloyd of them.
Yeah. Lloyd Tumley, who is kind of a key figure in the whole story. He's a former engineer on the railroad who we tracked down and who happened to be kind of an eyewitness to the third and fourth murder that happened in this town. And really, because of his quick thinking, really crucial in solving that murder quickly. And that kind of is where, you know, sort of a lot of these things, the sort of story here kind of hinges on what happens that day. I would also say that, like, we ended up talking to a former police officer there who was incredibly open with us, who we couldn't, I mean, he had really valuable insights on all of the murders that happened and a lot of the players around town. And also the widow of one of the men who was murdered also gave us a really interesting window into how maybe the GBI, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, wasn't necessarily just hostile towards us. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just us, maybe.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I don't want to give too much away, but there's a person who possibly could have committed Donna Brown's murder and may have been responsible for other murders in the area. And there's just this idea that maybe the authorities don't want to admit to putting the wrong person behind bars because it would mean they'd have to admit to have letting someone out who have possibly killed other people. I do want to ask, and it's important to ask, another organization has covered this case before and done a podcast, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and it was done a couple of years ago. Why did you guys want to do this, even though someone else had already done that kind of podcast, true crime podcast?
Well, I would say that we actually have been reporting on this story for more than 3 years. I don't know exactly when they started their podcast, but they didn't really actually report in any meaningful way on this case until after we had started our reporting. So it's not that we followed them. I think more likely we are journalists working on a similar story that actually in the end analysis take very different narrative tracks to telling the piece.
No, it is. I've listened to them both. I just was curious what you thought. What did you think, Liliana?
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. We listened to it when it first came out also because, you know, by then we were, by the time their podcast came out, we had been working on ours for a couple of years. And you know, I think it's always tough when somebody else is working on a very similar story or covering similar territory to you. But actually we came away, I think, fairly relieved and also remotivated because especially the episode that came out today covers a dimension of this story that really was unaddressed in that podcast. And that's one of the murder that remains unsolved that happened sort of in the middle of all of this. And the victim in that case was a man named Shailesh Patel. And it was really important to us to track that down, track down those family members, kind of, you know, confront that case, which is the one we knew the least about, and kind of, you know, probe deeper into that. So I think we added a lot to that investigation. But yeah, like Jordan said, I mean, we were already pretty deep into this project by the time that one came around. So we certainly didn't get the idea from them.
You could read the four long form articles about the same case on The Intercept's website about this case they're particularly working on. Episode 3 of Murderville is out today on all podcasting platforms. You can binge all 7 episodes on Stitcher Premium. Lydia Anna Segura and Jordan Smith, congratulations. A really great podcast, Murderville. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you
so much for having us.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. That's our show. I'm Allison Stewart, and I will see you next time.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.